TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Michael Osterholm, Coronavirus Update. Can we all return to normal now? Osterholm had told USA Today earlier this year, "We're just in the second inning of a 9-inning game." That's by members of the Midway Chamber of Commerce in Minnesota, met with him online on June 12, 2020. He gave an update and they asked him questions. Dr. Osterholm holds many titles and functions at the University of Minnesota, among them Regents Professor in Public Health, and he's Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, CIDRAP. He is Chad Kudas, Midway Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, everybody, for being here today. I'm Chad Kudas, Executive Director of the Midway Chamber. We're very excited to have our guest today. Dr. Michael Osterholm is one of the leading researchers in infectious disease and is an international leader on the critical concern regarding preparedness for an influenza pandemic. He is the author of the 2017 book, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs, in which he not only details the most pressing infectious disease threats of our day, but lays out a 9-point strategy on how to address them, with preventing a global flu pandemic at the top of his list.
Oh, thank you very much, Chad, for the opportunity to be with you today. I'll spend a few minutes just giving you a background update on where we're at, and then hopefully get to your questions and answer those. I'm sure you have many pressing ones, as we all do. When you talk about the concept of a pandemic, you're talking about a worldwide epidemic of a disease that basically puts everyone in the world at risk for acquiring that infection. The pandemics that have been of great concern over the history of humankind have been those caused largely by the respiratory tract, meaning those that are by breathing air you share with someone else. Those tend to be the most dynamic and over the years have been the killers, whether they be influenza or smallpox, particular pathogens like that. We've been concerned about influenza pandemics because, in fact, we have a history with those over the past 250 years. There have been 8 for certain and likely 10 such pandemics that have occurred. And each of those were situations where a new virus evolved out of a bird population and no longer was a bird virus, but became, through genetic changes, mutations, able to infect humans and humans transmitted around the world. Of those 10 influenza pandemics, they've all occurred at different times of the year when they started. 2 started in the Northern Hemisphere winter, 3 in the spring, 2 in the summer, and 3 in the fall. And in each instance, one of those, there was a first wave of illness that occurred throughout the world, but it was sporadic, meaning that you would see some cities, for example, in the United States hit and other cities not. 1918 was a classic example where you had cities like Chicago and New York that got particularly hard hit. Other cities in the same regions did not. And then for also unexplained reasons, the virus would basically just tail away, not because of human behavior change or anything we did. It would literally, in a sense, disappear. We don't understand why that happened. But it then is quiet for several months, and then all of a sudden it tends to come back. And the second wave is much, much larger than the first wave. They tend to be geographically universal across the world. And these are the ones we really fear. Well, this is what we were planning for. 1918 was an example of a very severe one where, in fact, over up to 200 million people died at a time when the world was just 1/4 the size it is today in population. To give you some perspective on that, even though the influenza pandemic was only there present in World War I for the last 3 months of the war, there are 8 times as many young U.S. soldiers buried in France from flu deaths than there are from the war itself. And so this has been a concern for some time. We've had subsequent pandemics in 1957, 1968, and 2009 that were not as severe, but did occur, did cause a lot of illnesses and deaths. And each one of those too have the same kind of pattern that I talked about. So I first wrote about this in the early 2000 time period and said, wake up world, these are gonna occur again. We have to be concerned about them. Then along comes this coronavirus. Coronaviruses get their name because they're a virus that looks like a crown. There's spikes on it. If you actually see it in the microscope, it looks just like a crowned kind of environment. And in this instance, we've had a history with coronaviruses in humans that have come from animals. Most notably, there are several that cause the common cold that do have some seasonality to it, not that severe. There's one that also does cause pneumonia, but it occurs very infrequently. The two that we have been most concerned about that emerged from animals to humans was SARS, severe acute respiratory distress syndrome, that occurred in 2003 and originated in the Guangdong province of China. There were over 9,000 cases, 900 deaths worldwide. And for this virus, we had two things happen that allowed us to basically, in a sense, eradicate it or at least eliminate it for the time being. One, we understood which were the animals in the markets of the Guangdong province that were spreading it. They were eliminated, so humans stopped getting pinged. And then in addition, we realized that humans were most infectious once they got infected only after 5 or 6 days of illness. Well, the same thing happened then with MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, in 2012, when it emerged on the Arabian Peninsula. And in that situation, the animal actually happened to be camels, which were not going to be eliminated from the markets. And for that matter, not really changed in any way how they're going to interact with people. And again, with MERS, we saw that most of the individuals did not have really any level of notable infectiousness until in the fourth or fifth day of illness. So there we continue to have cases. And in that instance, it's more a matter of we're just not going to get rid of the camels, but we stop human-to-human transmission. When you take a step back right now and look at the idea of, well, does MERS seasonally get spread, et cetera? SARS did not. SARS ended because we figured out how to stop it and get rid of the animal reservoir. I've been very involved working on MERS on the Middle East. I've been outside a hospital in Abu Dhabi when it was 110 degrees and MERS virus is transmitting very well, thank you. So again, we don't have a sense that coronaviruses automatically have to be seasonal. Well, then along comes this situation. Our center started tracking this in late December when we had the first inkling that something was happening in Wuhan, China, the major transportation hub in the center of China, located within the Hubei province. Wuhan itself has a population of about 11 million. The entire region, which is one continuous large city, has about 65 million people. And we saw this illness start that looked like almost like a SARS or MERS picture. And in fact, our first thought was in late December, early January, that no, this was going to be another SARS or MERS. We'll be able to control it just by basically identifying people early and isolating them so they don't transmit to others. But by the second week of January, it was clear to us that this was not another MERS or SARS, that in fact, transmission appeared to be very effective between people early in their illness, if not before their illness symptoms started, and that the respiratory transmission, very much like influenza, was very efficient. On January 20th, we put out a document that basically said, this will cause a worldwide pandemic. There's no way the Chinese can contain this. We had ample information from China by that time that in fact this was going to happen. So if you hear messages that somehow this was hidden, while the Chinese surely in December did not provide the information that at that time about what was happening, I have to honestly say it's probably not that dissimilar than what would have happened in the fog of an outbreak here in the United States initially. But by early January, we were getting the information. On January 11th, the Chinese actually published the entire sequence of the genetic sequence of the virus so we could start building tests, even start working on vaccines. And in that January time period, we also put out that this was going to not only spread worldwide, but that because we now understood that it looked like the incubation period, or the period from the time you get infected until you actually get sick and are infectious, or just slightly before that, is about 5 days. And it looked like on average, people tend to infect about 2 people. So you go from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 to 32. And it takes a while before you build up sufficient numbers of cases, particularly when a large chunk of them will be have only moderate to mild illness before the world would find out. So it wasn't a surprise to us at all. We predicted that late February, early March, we'd start seeing cases around the world, particularly in highly dense populations, exactly what this virus did. It wasn't a surprise, nothing there, other than the fact that just watching what kind of illness it could cause. And so I want to give you that background because I also want to emphasize I'm at the end of my skis right now. At this point, we don't know what's going to happen next. A couple of points. This virus is very efficiently spread by respiratory transmission, this kind of aerosols, just breathing in a room. Today, all of us sitting in the rooms we're in right now, in the period of time that I've been talking to you, just breathing, you have created a perfume of aerosols in your room. And if I could light them up with a ultraviolet light, you would see what appears to be exactly what you see when you look at the sunlight coming through your window sometimes and see the dust floating that appears, oh my, my house is dusty. That's aerosols. And that's what you have with this particular transmission. Another way to look at it, when we open department stores and you're four aisles away from that perfume area, you'll smell the perfume four aisles away. That's again, an aerosol. So that's number one. This is a very efficient transmitting virus. Number two is the fact that to date, we estimate no more than 5 to 20% of the U.S. population has been infected. 20% is only in certain areas of the New York City metropolitan area. The vast majority of the United States is in the 5% range. And for that matter, most of the world is in a 5% range. Studies out of France, Spain, Germany, all in the last week have all demonstrated that about that percentage has been infected. Why is that important? Because this virus is operating under a very basic principle of basically physics, chemistry, and biology. And it responds to viral gravity, as I call it. This is going to keep trying to transmit to humans until at least 60 or 70% of humans have been infected and hopefully develop some kind of what we call durable immunity. And that means it's going to last for more than just a few weeks after you're infected and recover. And that's a long ways from 5 to 15%. So when you think about what this disease has done in terms of pain, suffering, death, and even economic disruption, it's only been for 5% for most of the country, and we're not going to rest until it gets to 60 or 70%. Now, we can get there two ways. We can get there either through natural infection, or we can get there through a vaccine. At this point, I'm happy to address issues around the vaccine. I caution you about the happy talk that continues to occur about it. I more than anything want to see a vaccine, but it's not forthcoming in the days and weeks and even months ahead, as some people propose. There's a lot of challenges with this vaccine. We don't know if we can actually get permanent immunity or long-term immunity. There are safety issues with this virus in terms of what it does. And just the issue of manufacturing and distribution is going to be a huge challenge for something like this. So how are we going to get to that 5 or 15% to 60 or 70%? And then I want to emphasize, even at 60 to 70%, the virus doesn't stop transmitting. It just slows down. So, well, our center came up with a document that was published several weeks ago. I would urge you to go look at our website. If you want more information, it's www.cidrap.umn.edu. cidrap.umn.edu. And there's a document on there under the CIDRAP viewpoints on scenarios in which we've laid out. One, this is a coronavirus. So again, as I said, I'm at the edge of my headlights or skis, and we don't know what it's going to do from here. But if it follows basic an influenza-like model, my biggest fear is that in the course of the next 3 to 8 weeks, we're actually going to see this virus just kind of go away, which seems so, you know, inconsistent. How could I say that? It sounds almost amoral. Well, I surely don't want anyone to become ill. I don't want anyone to get seriously ill or die. But the bottom line, if it goes away, then it's telling me this is starting to act like a flu virus. And if that's the case, it's very likely we could have a major peak of activity late summer and early fall that would be, in fact, devastating. It could be. And so we have to entertain that possibility. That's one. The other possibilities are coronavirus, and we lay this out in this document, could be it's just as on a slow burn. It just continues the level it is right now. And as a society, we just figure out how we're going to live with this as well as die with it and move forward. And then the other one could be that we have the situation where we just have what we call kind of the foothills or the ups and downs, regional outbreaks that are not maybe as bad as New York, but they just keep occurring and occurring and occurring, but it's going to take us a long time. Previous pandemics like this took years, not months. And that's what I think people don't understand right now. That's what we're talking about, the potential here in terms of what we could be putting up with and how we're going to have to learn. As I've said, we unfortunately had to learn how to die with this virus. I can tell you, having had friends who have died, watching healthcare workers at risk and of dying, doing their job, this has been a very, very painful thing to learn about. But at the same time, we're going to have to learn how to live with it, because this is not going to go away. Anybody who comes away from today's webcast here with the idea that this is just get over the hump and get to summer, you didn't listen. This is not going to go away soon. I say that in the context, again, I want to emphasize that it could see a big decrease in cases in the short term, but they could surely come back with a vengeance. So I think that's the one thing that we have to keep in mind. The second thing I would say is, how do we get through whatever months it's going to take to, if we do get an effective vaccine? And I look at the two guardrails on this situation as, one, we locked down like they did in Wuhan for 12 to 18 weeks where nobody left their houses, but for one person every week to go out for an hour and get groceries under surveillance. You know, are we going to be able to do that? It'd make anything we've done so far seem mild. And I think we'd all agree that would not just destroy our economy, that would destroy society. We can't do that. It won't work. And it will be a challenge that the question would be, what have we really done? On the other side, the guardrail is, we just can't let this go willy-nilly. If you think about this, in my career, I always feared this, but I hope that I'd never see it. Not since 1918 have we seen what's happened in the last 2 months. 80 days ago, this virus was not even in the top 100 causes of death in this country, not even in the top 100. For a better part of the last 5 weeks, this virus has been the number one cause of death in this country. Cook County just did a review and announced yesterday, 55% of all deaths in Cook County, Chicago area, since January 1 have been due to COVID. That gives you some sense of the power and impact. And again, I just can't say it strongly enough. This is just getting started. This is just the warm-up. This is not the big harangue yet. So I think that that's what we have to understand as a society. We're going to be coming in and out potentially of serious challenges with this for some time to come. And I don't have any other way to say that. We can't let the healthcare systems go down because of this extreme number of cases that can come in for several reasons. One is just the care for the COVID patients. Number two is we put healthcare workers at risk every day. We're already still short of professional or protective equipment for these people, PPE. And if we're short now, imagine what we could be like if we have a big peak coming this fall. So we surely want to hold that down. The third thing is that we're looking at mortality data right now from a number of areas of the country that were severely hit by COVID, where people didn't die from COVID. They died from heart attacks, they died from strokes, they died from accidents, et cetera, where they couldn't get adequate care because the healthcare systems where they would have gone to were so overly burdened and directed at COVID care. So we all have a reason for not wanting these hospitals and healthcare systems to be choked up with this kind of situation. So let me just say at this point, what can we do about it? Testing is a very important issue. We're putting out a document tomorrow. However, testing has really been misunderstood. This mantra of test, test, test is terribly misdirected. You want what we call smart testing. We'll define that at some length in this document that's coming out tomorrow. And in that, it will talk about, you want the basically the right person to get tested at the right time with the right test for the right reasons, and that there's the right results that occur about that test that we protect the individual and the public health. That has to be done. We're still talking about the concept of contact tracing. I fear that people have taken this on much like they did after post 9/11 when everybody had their bottle of ciprofloxacin and the anthrax situation and said, in Cipro we trust. You know, it's that kind of situation. Contact tracing has a ton of challenges to it about making it work and how it worked. If we have time, we can go into those. And so that's not going to be a magic bullet. So you're looking to me saying, so what the hell are you going to do then, Mike? And that's our challenge. We are basically at this point short of just not swapping air with people who might be infected, unknowingly infected. We don't have a lot of tools. And, you know, we can talk about masks, we can talk about all these things. Bottom line is that we have to start planning as if we're going to get through this without all the convenient ways of saying, well, that will be easy. This is a 4-7 hurricane potentially coming down the pike. Even if we don't have the big peak, even if we just have the slow burn, you've seen what this virus has done to our society. And let me just say that it's been a terribly unfortunate situation, and I have seen it front and center, how this virus has continued to divide our country and how it's divided communities. This virus has caused tremendous economic implications for people. I personally know that all too well in family and friends. So I don't want anybody to think that this is a bunch of public health people who just are making recommendations needlessly. We have to understand what it's doing to the community and how we address that, how we change with that, and what it means. But at the same time, you can't defy viral gravity. This thing's going to do what it's going to do. And it's not about public health message. We're not the enemy. It's about the actual virus. And I think what we've tried to do at our center, I have a weekly podcast. We surely have a very active web-based presence. Just tell the truth, what we know and don't know, and what we're going to do to try to get through, and what we can say with certainty that works or doesn't work, and where do we go from here. My recommendations right now, just to give you some sense, I advise the American Council on Education, which is the all the major college presidents. I'm actually, as a faculty member at the university, I also am a member of the Board of Regents of Luther College in Iowa. My message is go for it. Plan for the full fall. But you better have very detailed plans in your back pocket that you can stop in a dime and give back 9 cents change if you need to. That's how we should be approaching our lives right now. So with that, Chad, I will happy to address any questions I can. And as I said, if I know the answer, I'll give you the reason why I know it. And if I don't know it, I'll tell you that and try to find out that information.
That's Dr. Michael Osterholm, Regents Professor in Public Health at the University of Minnesota and one of the leading researchers in infectious diseases. He's internationally in demand for advice on how to prepare for an influenza pandemic. You are listening to excerpts of his report to the Midway Chamber of Commerce in Minnesota. They spoke online on June 12, 2020. Chad Kudas is the host.
Well, first question, people have heard from others who have said, you know, back in January, I was sick, and now looking back, I wonder if that was actually COVID-19. Somebody in the chat is asking, is it possible that COVID-19 hit Minnesota before March?
First of all, COVID-19 was actually starting to spread around the world as early as November. We have confirmed cases now from samples that were collected, and that's not a surprise. When you look at global trade and travel, we knew that this virus was in Wuhan in mid-November. And again, this is the transportation hub for China. You don't go anywhere in China practically without going through Wuhan, whether it be from Beijing to Shanghai, Hong Kong, whatever. And same is true with air flights. So yes, we do have cases, but many of the people who thought they had cases have actually been tested by antibody and they're negative. They didn't have it. We have a lot of respiratory type agents that occur during the wintertime. Only about 20% at most are influenza. And there are a number of other viruses that sometimes can make you feel really bad. So was it widespread? Absolutely it was not, but we do have sporadic cases that are confirmed, and the most important message is it is now everywhere in the world.
Somebody says that they work with people with disabilities. Can they open their doors again in 2021, or is remote going to be the new normal?
Well, we will have a new normal. It doesn't matter what it is. It's just like air flight after 9/11. It was a new normal. The question is, can we ever go back to not having to be worried about masks, et cetera, et cetera? You know, right now, and this is, if you're contacted the health department, they tell you the same thing. Our evidence right now is we probably have the highest level of virus activity in Minneapolis, St. Paul, that we've had since this whole thing began. So it seems somewhat ironic that we're actually talking about releasing or relaxing the distancing issues. But again, this is a societal issue that public health is only one avenue of what we have to talk about. What is it doing to the rest of society? I would tell you right now, and this is what's really challenging, because you're looking at, you know, example number one sitting in this side of the camera, and that is, if you're over 65, if you're a male, if you're overweight, particularly any age, if you have a BMI of more than 35, moderately obese, which 45% of our population is, if you've had underlying heart disease, you have hypertension, you have diabetes, you have renal disease, of which 790,000 Americans do today have end-stage renal disease. If you've had certain blood cancers or lung cancers, we're all at increased risk of, if we get infected, of actually having a serious illness and potentially dying. That's 40% of our state's population of adults. So that is a challenge. How do we keep from getting infected? And I think this is where we need to have really hard discussions. We've been trying to have this. As I talk about it, threading the needle with the rope, put that rope through the needle. How do we get between those two guardrails? Can't let our healthcare systems crash and collapse. by many, many people die. How do we keep from having a lockdown that's doing the devastating economic implications? And again, we're the first to tell you there are substantial health implications to this economic issue by themselves. We're talking about many, many people in this country losing health insurance. We're talking about people in mental health issues, stress, the severity, on and on. But how do we navigate that in between? And that's the challenge we have right now, is how to have that discussion. I don't know how to tell you to bubble 40% of Minnesota's adults. I don't know how to tell you to do it. I can tell you right now that the face of this pandemic will change substantially over the course of the next several months. Right now, it's easy to dismiss who's becoming infected and dying. And I've heard this, painfully heard this. It's old people, long-term care facilities. It's prisoners. People in drug treatment centers are homeless people. People who work in meatpacking plants, and we know who many of those people are. You know, they're not from here. These have been painful issues, but let me just make it very clear. These are what we call congregate care or congregate work areas, where people are basically touching each other, close by each other. And if you had only one out of every 500 people in this community that were infected, if one of those people goes to work at a nursing home or is a family member coming to visit somebody in that nursing home, it's like putting a match to a gas can. Boosh, suddenly 40% of the entire facility is infected. Same thing is true in meatpacking. Within the next 3 to 6 months, we're burning through those facilities so quickly, we're starting to get to 60 to 70% infected, or they've died. And the challenge is that in the next 6 months, that's not going to be the face of this pandemic. It's going to be you and me. It's going to be, this will continue to sweep through. I promise you this, I can say this with certainty, there won't be any blue states and red states as this really goes on. It'll be all COVID color states.
You heard excerpts from a one-hour interview with Professor Michael Osterholm, one of the leading researchers in infectious diseases and an internationally acclaimed public health professional. Osterholm is the author of the 2017 book, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs. He not only details the most pressing infectious disease threats of our day, but most importantly, lays out a 9-point strategy on how to address them. For daily updates and a weekly podcast, go to Osterholm's organization, CIDRAP, the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, works to prevent illness and death. They translate scientific information into real-world practical applications, policies, and solutions. Thanks to Chad Kudas, Executive Director of the Midway Chamber of Commerce. He hosted this interview with Professor Osterholm on June 12, 2020. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.